Thank you very much. I'm Andres Rodriguez Posse, and I am a professor of economic geography here at the London School of Economics. And for me, it's really a great pleasure to introduce Jacques Pote, who's going to be talking about, as I said before, a very topical issue that is being talked about by everyone. So the issues of migration, how it shapes the future of international migration, how the weight of evidence is changing migration. And it's also important for me because Jacques Pote is the president-elect of the Regional Science Association and a fellow of the Regional Science Association International, and he's going to be replacing me in a year's time as president of the association. Just a few words about Jacques' background. He's one of the foremost experts on migration topics, and especially combining the geographical aspects of migration, and he's the professor of population economics at the National Institute of Demographic and Economic Analysis at the University of Waikato, of course, being funded by the foundation in New Zealand. He has received his bachelor and master's degree from the Free University of Amsterdam and a doctorate from the Victoria University of Wellington, so he's a migrant himself, he knows what he's talking about, and has plenty of international experience as he has taught at the University of Tsukuba in Japan in two different periods of time, and has been employed also in different guises at Victoria University of Wellington between 1979 and 2003. His research interests include all aspects of economics of population, such as migration, fertility, labour force and ageing, especially focusing, as I said before, on the geographical dimensions of these topics. He's currently the principal investigator of a publicly funded research on capturing the diversity dividend of Aotearoa, I hope I pronounced it correctly, New Zealand, that is going to last until 2020. And this research program has been undertaken by staff at Massey University, Waikato University, and Motu Economic and Public Policy Research. He has previously co-led very large-scale projects in New Zealand and in Europe on immigrant integration, migration and regional disparities, and on regional population change and socioeconomic consequences. We are lucky enough as well to have Professor Jonathan Wadsworth, who is going to be the respondent to Jacques's lecture. But without further ado, I would like to introduce Jacques Pote, talking about can the weight of evidence on impacts shape the future of international migration. Jacques.
Tēnā koutou. Tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou katoa. Sir Graham Davies, Professor Andres Rodriguez Posse, Professor Jonathan Wadsworth, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for this opportunity tonight to address you about a topic which I'm very passionate about. I'm really very grateful for the opportunity to be in the UK and to address this lecture with the sponsorship of the NZUK Link Foundation. And as Sir Graham Davies said, the requirements were to give four lectures, public lectures in the UK. I can now inform him this is the last lecture, but this is actually the 10th I've given in my three-month period. So I think the foundation can be happy with the return on their investment. I normally, when I give a talk, tend to talk off the cuff. And that works very well, but I quite often halfway end up with not enough time to finish to say everything that I wanted to say. So I hope you'll excuse me for sticking a little more to the script that I've prepared for today. And hopefully, because there are points that I want to make that are towards the end, that I will be able hopefully to capture in this period that is assigned to this lecture. First of all, of course, there's this question, can the weight of evidence on impact shape the future of international migration? Well, of course it can, but whether it does or not is another matter. And in fact, we probably all believe that it should, because we believe in evidence-based policymaking. And clearly, international migration is one of the biggest policy issues at present, not just from the perspective of destination countries, but also from the sending countries' perspective. And therefore, it's a global issue and a major aspect of international relations. But there is a fundamental asymmetry in that the right to leave is almost universal, the right to arrive is controlled, the right to stay is even more controlled. Still, international migration links all parts of the world, as this particular picture shows you. And I recommend that you go to that website, because this is an interactive website. It lets you delve into these different flows. This picture just shows you how the world is connected through migration flows, big flows, small flows. You can really delve into this. This is for the period 2005-2010. You can go back into history. However, the persistence by some to continue to treat international migration as a domestic issue can lead to tragic consequences, as the events of this year have clearly made us aware of. International migration, my view, links among the biggest global policy issues right now. That would include environmental degradation, climate change, failing nation state, insecurity, financial instability, contagion, etc. The extensive and ongoing media coverage of these subjects means that we all have an opinion. In fact, there are 7 billion opinions in this world linked to the internet, because there are now 7 billion cell phones around the world, almost as many as there are people. So irrespective of the scientific evidence, opinions vary widely. And why is that? Because of the distributional impacts. It matters more for some than for others. And these distributional impacts across people and across places are far bigger than the average global impact. So in this lecture, I'm going to first argue that international migration is a big challenge today, but will become an even bigger challenge into the future. Hence, we need a high-quality evidence base. We'll focus primarily here on the weight of the evidence generated by economists, because that's what I am, that's what I know best, make no apology for that. Although I will show that the work that economists are doing these days is also quite often linked now with the works of other disciplines. We're doing a lot of multi-method, multidisciplinary teamwork, which I'll come back to later. I'm also going to refer for the evidence base to some international work using meta-analysis, which I know well, which I'm going to show is very important in this context, and to some New Zealand evidence. I'm also going to describe how the evidence has been used in New Zealand policy making. And there, in fact, we have something good to show, because in New Zealand there's a good link between the policy community and the scientific community. But, and this is true everywhere, that doesn't necessarily mean that we are able to influence or inform public attitudes to the extent that we would like to. And I will talk about why that is so. Finally, I'll suggest pathways through which researchers and policymakers can move towards more effective evidence-based policy development. Well, the trend I think you all will be familiar with. The UN data shows that there's been particularly strong growth since the 1980s, which was the point at which this globalization of capital, labor, trade, information, communication technology, cross-border integration all started to really take off. Of course, the current situation in the Middle East and Northern Africa has triggered an acceleration in the trends, and so although the official data finished by 2013, based on the information I've collected on what's happened since then, my estimate is right now 250 million people now lives outside their country of birth. And this includes, by the way, some of the asylum seekers and refugees, not all, because there's 60 million displaced people in the world right now, of whom about 20 million have already crossed a border. You won't be surprised, of course, that Europe has had the fastest growth in immigration of all the continents, when on average there being 2.75 times as many immigrants in 2013 as there were in 1980. So what can we expect for the future? Well, right now, this quarter of a billion people still only represents 3.5% of the world population. And they're very unevenly spread, of course, with, if you go across countries, Australia, New Zealand, it's about 1 out of 4 now as an immigrant. Here in the UK, it's 1 out of 8. Countries like Finland, Hungary, it's 5%. So it varies a lot across countries. But UK growth, as you can see, is there given. It's about 2.33 over the 2013-1980 period. It's actually a little bit less than average in Europe, whereas in New Zealand, we've actually had more immigration than our biggest kind of Oceania partner country, is it within Oceania, Australia, is the other country that would have made up the Oceania average to the largest extent. So we've had a lot of immigration. In fact, and the consequence of that is if you compare Auckland and London, London, of course, very diverse city like Auckland, we've got now 39% foreign-born in Auckland. It's 37% in London. So we could also use the weight of the evidence to talk about what are the drivers of future migration. Firstly, demography tells us a lot. If you start looking at the population pyramids across countries, you see, and you know about that, we know population trends are right up to the middle of the century. There's very little that you can, at the margin it can change, but the momentum of population change is unchangeable. The drivers include then of migration the huge demographic differences in the aging population in the developed world and the still very youthful populations in the developing world. Then we have these persistently cross-country differences in per capita income, continued urbanization and agglomeration. The big cities grow more than the rest, and cities are what attract migrants. We've got continuing sharp declines in the cost of travel, keeping in touch, further global economic integration, movements of footloose capital, something that is actually still have difficulty coming to grips with exactly where it goes and how it moves around the world. Diminishing attachment to place, a cultural thing. Political instability and climate change. So what we see as a response is intensifying border controls, political decentralization and localization, which may be slowing down the trend. But as has been said at many high-level forums in recent months, the future is about managing the migration, not about reversing the trends. While it requires a lot of assumptions, my colleague Shefali Power and I have been trying to look at what cities look like in the future. So we've done projections of the urban population using UN data, and here I compare Europe and Oceania. You can download the article. It's got lots of stuff for the whole world. Grey refers to the population 65 and over, and we also have the urban population that's migrant in this chart, which is less than the grey in Europe and more than the grey in Oceania. So there's a contrast there. European cities are more grey than diverse. Oceania more diverse than grey. And the trend, of course, ageing will take place everywhere. But you can see that also migration will continue to change everywhere. But it does affect the composition of the cities. So much of the new immigration, in fact, will be quite different from that in the past. Migration flows are becoming a lot more complex than they used to be. Historical migration is a once-in-a-lifetime event. What we see now is more and more temporary migration of different types. You take there, for example, return migration, between 20 to 50%, depending on the circumstances, country, time period, of migrants are returning. or going somewhere else. So there's this huge mobility. We also have a lot of transnational commuting now. So we have multi-country residents, cross-border commuting. My suggestion is that all migration will grow, but the temporary, more complex forms will grow more than the traditional forms. And I'll just give you the New Zealand evidence on this. This has been happening in New Zealand since 2005. We've had growth in immigration, quite strong growth in recent years. What you see here is the different categories. Now, Australians and New Zealanders returning are a very interesting group because it's like the European Union. Australians have the right to go to New Zealand whenever they like. There's no border control for them. They just hop on a plane. New Zealanders, of course, can return at any time. The traditional form of migration, residence migration, as you can see, hasn't been growing much at all. Strong growth has been in working 12 months or more, so work permits, and also in the student group. We've had huge growth in student numbers in New Zealand. So what are the consequences of immigration for destination countries? When you look at these trends, there are many types of consequences. And in order to kind of put this all together, some colleagues of myself and I have started using a particular term for this. We call it Migration Impact Assessment, or MIA. And it provides scientific quantification of the effects of migration on these whole range of issues, which I'll all come back to, obviously not in much detail, but I'm going to try to cover them all. Some of them, the first block, are actually ones that we know a lot about by now, such as fiscal impacts. I'm going to tell you, even in the UK, we know a lot about that. And Jonathan Wadsworth might comment on that as well. There's a lot, in fact, in common among a number of developed countries in terms of these impacts. However, it's much harder to estimate some impacts that we're still struggling with, which what is the long-run effect? So what does it do to things like innovation and growth, social cohesion, attitudes of people, infrastructure? We'll look into some of that, but we'll see that there are maybe still more issues in that respect. Now, MIA has actually a very long history in Australia and New Zealand. The reason is that after World War II, those countries wanted to grow their population by migration because they felt they were underpopulated. So they had these immigration policies, including, of course, considerable migration from the UK to New Zealand. There's now 250,000 people born in the UK living in New Zealand right now. And this was already looked at by economists, right going back to the 1950s, famous economists like Horace Belshaw, John Gould, Sir Frank Holmes, and the Monetary and Economic Council. Their perspective on migration was actually rather negative. They were worried about immigration as economists in New Zealand. Why? Because in the economic conditions of those times, they felt that immigration was creating too much demand pressure. Not enough resources in New Zealand, too much demand. What happens? Inflation goes up and the balance of payments deteriorates. So that was their worry. Since then, though, the debate has moved to other parts of the world, and it's also moved on in different topics. The key examples from the literature are the work of economists in the US, like George Borjas, who's been working particularly on what the wage impact is of immigrants in the host societies, on natives particularly, as well as, well, we'll come back to immigrants as well. In fact, Barry Chiswick was the person who's been particularly looking at how do immigrants integrate and what will be their wages, how will their wages change over time. So here's the main references. In Australasia, in Australia, New Zealand, we've been having a kind of different approach in two ways. One is governments have found this topic so important that they've been willing to fund research on it, going back right to the 1980s, including research that have been benefited from as a researcher from the funding. Myself, in the mid-1980s, work that I did with colleagues Ganesh Nana and Brian Philpott, In Australia, they did something similar to what we did in New Zealand, work by Norman and Michael. I'll come back a bit to what we actually did using large computer models later on. Now, clearly, there's also huge European literature now, but it would be fair to say that it started late, but has certainly caught up now. For example, we have here, there's many research institutes which I've had the privilege of visiting now throughout the UK, Oxford, Leeds, Southampton. But here also in London, we have the Centre for Research and Analysis of Migration, of which Professor Wadsworth is the Deputy Director. And they turn out regularly many publications that are relevant to this topic. Now I'm going to indulge in one slide of Econ 101, because some of you may not be economists. I think it's the slide that is the simplest migration impact assessment that actually tells you a lot of what the core of the issue is. So we've got the supply of N people in a country, represented by this S line. We've got the demand, which is downward sloping, because the productivity of additional workers goes down if you don't increase capital and infrastructure. So for a given resources, in that term, we will have a downward sloping demand curve. Then when the supply and demand meet, we end up with wage W, and we have the red area, which is all what goes to the workers collectively, and we've got the blue triangle, which is the return to the owners of capital, like buildings, machines, and the like. So what happens if we increase the population through migration? We add another N people to this. The picture becomes a little bit more complicated. You see that there's a green area now, which is the wages going to the migrants. We have a orange area, which is actually what used to go to the native-born workers, but has now been passed on to the capitalists in the host society. Then we have a triangle, which is what George Boris calls the immigration surplus, which is the additional bit of GDP that comes out of this process. In the first instance, as the simple picture says, it goes to the capitalists. So this looks like a lot of kind of loss and maybe some gain, also, and a net gain, but in terms of the workers, not the best possible story. But have we told the whole story? Well, if there is going to be more resources, and there's every reason to believe that if businesses see opportunities resulting from this higher rate of return to capital, there will be more capital flowing in, there will be more infrastructure. If it is, then the demand will go up as well. That demand curve doesn't stay where it is. It will do that, and I'll leave it to you to fill in the picture with lots of, you know, little bits of colour where it's missing. So what are the labour market impacts in the classic theory? Well, as I said before, so if the migrants and the locals are perfect substitutes, close substitutes in the labour market, and there's no additional capital forthcoming, the destination country may expect a decrease in wages, an increase in employment overall, but a decline in employment of the native-born, a decrease in labour force participation, an increase in unemployment. And the story would be the opposite for the sending countries in the standard model. But if migrants and natives are not close substitutes, the story becomes quite different. You can show, and George Boras does in an eloquent paper that you can download, and there's a lot of, you know, the textbooks now, well, some of them will have this proof of this as well. If, as long as they're very different, they'll become complement. Migrants and natives are very different in production. I'll say a bit more about that later on as well. In fact, wages and employment of the natives can easily increase. So it's all about to what extent are natives and migrants substitutes. Just want to point out briefly again, though, this is a global issue. It's not just a domestic issue. In a book chapter that some colleagues of mine, Stefan Brunau, Peter Nijkamp, and I published early this year, we looked for the whole world. We try to identify who are the winners and who are the losers, going through all these different interest groups. So we look at owners of capital, workers, residents, citizens, diaspora, And what you can see is using the standard economic model, there are winners and losers, but the world as a whole gains. An article by Michael Clemens suggests that if the world allows for greater labor mobility overall, there are, in his words, $1 trillion bills lying on the sidewalk for humanity to pick up when they allow greater mobility. What we do, however, need, of course, and that's the crux of the issue, is an effective, efficient, and fair means of distributing the gains among those who are losing out in this process. So much for the theory. Let's now get to the evidence. Economists and policymakers are more and more now turning to meta-analysis for this. Why? Well, it's been around for decades in medicine, the behavioral sciences, and Jean Glass is the one who introduced this term. He's an educational psychologist. The advantage of meta-analysis is it allows you to compare a whole bunch of findings in the right way so that you take account of differences between studies and differences in quality and come up with some kind of overall average. And so I've done this with some colleagues for the labor market impact, because that was one of the big issues, remember. So this is what we see here is a combination of a number of meta-analyses published in a journal that's mentioned there, Environment and Planning C. So what we're doing here is, in fact, not just using one meta-analysis, we combined a bunch of meta-analyses. So I guess you could say, well, this is a meta-squared kind of study, right? So what we did was we put together all the evidence that there was in the world on this topic. And if you look at wages, start with at this time, actually there weren't that many studies that were directly comparable initially. See, there's some larger numbers on the right of the table there. You can still end up with 344 different estimates. The reason for this is that because each study will give you more than one estimate. The average of this is minus 0.12%. Let me tell you what that means in the UK context. Right now, there's 12.5% people here are overseas born. If you increase that from 12.5% to 13.5%, that's a 1% increase, wages would go down on average by, at most, if you believe that average there, 0.1%, at most. Of course, there's a wide range between -5.4% to +4.5%. And moreover, the simple average is a very unscientific thing to do. You go across studies, you have to take into account that some studies are higher quality than others. Some of them are having more higher statistical significance. When you do all that and all the different conditions under which these studies are conducted, we get a different number, -0.21. Still pretty much the same conclusion qualitatively, maybe a 0.2% decline in wages. Do the same for employment. We see that this virtually, the original average shows a slightly bigger effect. Then for wages, the meta-analytic average is basically zero. No change in employment. You can just look at statistical significance. You get far larger numbers of studies because, you know, t-statistics, everyone collects t-statistics. It's not easy to compare them. You can do it. You find that the effect basically is insignificant in both counts, for wages and employment. Now you may argue, if some of you are from the experimental sciences, yes, you'll say, but you economists and other social scientists loving to run regressions, you got it wrong because you don't have an experimental background. You use observational research, and there's always, you know, the observational, the unobserved, the observational limitations. So let me tell you a little bit about what economists call a natural experiment. The most celebrated natural experiment in this context is called the Mariel Boatlift, which was a mass emigration of people from Cuba in 1980. 1980 was a bad year for Cuba, had a bad economy, and there was unrest. So Fidel Castro agreed that people could leave if they wanted to. from about April to October. Most of the immigrants, and there were lots of them, 125,000 people left Cuba in that small period of time. And most of them ended up going to Miami. In fact, to the extent that Miami's workforce increased by 7% almost overnight. So if you want to see an experiment where the migration affects what's going on in the city, this was a really good experiment. David Card did exactly, and US economists did exactly that. What did he find? Wages go down, lots of unemployment, big outcry, all sorts of unrest. No, virtually nothing changed. Rents went up. I'll come back to that later on. That did happen. But wages and employment. So, now you want to know, that's 1980. What does it mean for today? So I thought, let's just take Germany today. 2 million immigrants are expected for 2015, plus including refugees. So, but, and here it comes, politicians forget this. There's a huge emigration, even at the best of times. The migration is a churning process. Based on the statistics I saw for Germany for last year, probably 800,000 people will be leaving Germany this year. Okay? So what do we have? A net balance of 1.2 million, which is about 1.5% of Germany's population. That's a quarter of what happened in Miami. Now you'll say, Miami is a city. Germany is a huge country. Migrants settle in big cities. So imagine that they would settle just in the big cities of Germany. You might find an effect which is four times the country effect, and four times 1.5 is 6%. That's still only of the magnitude of what happened in Miami. Now, I will say, as a careful scientist, transferring of research from one study, from one country, one institutional context to another is hazardous. I'm not saying you should just do that and just say, well, this is the answer. But as a kind of rough order of magnitude, there's still a message here, I think. So what can explain the zero wage impact? Well, first of all, a larger population does attract more business. I mentioned that before. Secondly, there's a huge increase when you have new people coming in services, local services. Think of restaurants, haircuts, shops, all these kind of things. But also public services, healthcare, education. Thirdly, there, of course, is some movement of the locals. Locals may move to other parts of the city, so where away from where the migrants settled, or to other cities, thereby reducing local labour supply. So the research has greatly moved now to looking at national impacts rather than local to take account of this. And when you do that, and we've done meta-analysis of that as well, the effect is bigger. So the national impact on wages, if it is negative, is some bigger than it would be the local level. But even so, it's still rather small. Why? Well, there are these other things that are going on. First of all, immigrants and natives tend to work in different areas. They work in different sectors. They have different occupations. Also, firms change the way in which they do things in a country that is allows in immigration. The sectors that use immigrants most will exploit this in the sense that they expand more and they also change their production technology to take account of that availability of migrant labour. So what you would conclude again is it's all about substitution. The people who might bear the brunt of the impact are those who are closest to the new arrivals. And there's a lot of evidence, including meta-analysis, on this. So the people who bear the brunt are those who directly substitute for the migrants in terms of skills, backgrounds, and that could also include, of course, the locally born people. Said before, even if there's no wage effect, there may be a housing effect. This impact is very localized because migrants tend to cluster. So there has been a lot of research on looking at this, the effect on rents and house prices. Albert Seis, a U.S. economist found that based on his work, both using across cities in the U.S. and also he went to the Miami experiment as well, check what happened there. He found that generally a 1% increase in the migrant share of population increases rents by 1%. So it is an increase, but again, a 1 percentage point increase in migrants is quite a lot, right? It's not just 1%, it's an increase in migrants as a share of the population. That's quite a lot. So a 1% increase in rise in rents and house prices. He did find that in Miami, the suburb, the areas where the migrants were located, rents went up more. So it was quite a localized effect. He also found that house prices there went down as locals were starting to move out. And that's a theme that I found in a lot of the recent research across also other parts of the world. There is an effect of this movement of locals. There's no doubt about it. And it does affect the housing market. However, what we find right now in New Zealand is that currently migrants are being blamed for the house price boom. Does that sound familiar to you? We have had a huge increase in house. Auckland is one of the most expensive cities in the world to live, like as is London. But I would say, careful there. Don't go fall for the trap of reverse causation. Cities that are buoyant, where a lot is happening, where there's a lot of job growth, where there's lots of amenities, are the cities which attract migrants. So we do see this correlation, but is it causation? You need to be careful before you draw that conclusion. Let's now briefly talk about the outcomes for migrants themselves. The story that I give here, the pictures are directly from New Zealand evidence. They are, however, typical of this literature. So here we're looking at employment rates of migrants by the years that they're in the country. What you see here is that it takes some time. Migrants start out about 20% lower. You can do similar pictures for wages. It turns out it's about 10 to 15% lower. And all of these pictures, by the way, are conditional on all sorts of things. Clearly, skills, language, age, time of arrival, all these kind of things matter. It's not, the average does hide a lot of variation. There's no doubt about that. Nonetheless, there is a catching up. And as you can see here, it does take on average about 10 years. And for wages, actually, it might take even a bit longer than that. Now, there are also other areas of impact that are covered already in early lectures. So I'll just, with one slide, tell you what I said in these previous lectures as a kind of high-level conclusion. Each of those lectures will be available from the Foundation's website if you want to watch the video at a future night, day, whatever. Generally, impact on tax revenue is larger than on public expenditure. This fiscal impact I discussed in Southampton is actually a topic widely debated also here in the UK. Now, work by Christian Dustman and others here, and Jonathan can comment on this, published in top journals, shows very clearly that there is a net positive impact for a country like the UK. It's not true for all European countries. It does depend on the composition of the migrants in terms of the skills. Those with higher skills and more income will be contributing more than those with lesser skills. The net impact is also bigger the longer you're in the country, and that's true for all kind of migrants. And moreover, as is clear, it would be bigger the longer it takes before you are eligible for Social Security. In New Zealand, it takes 2 years before a migrant is eligible for New Zealand Social Security. On growth and innovation, I talked at Oxford and noted that it's not easy to find effects. There are effects there. It's econometrically quite hard to separate them from everything else that's going on in the economies. In the short run, economies get scaled up, so more immigrants will give a country a bigger GDP, but the question is per capita. Per capita, not much may be happening. It's generally unaffected in the short run. In the long run, you may see a positive effect. as our paper that I mentioned earlier on with Stephen Brunau and Peter Nijkamp suggested. There's a lot of work done on cultural diversity of cities, and glad to see Max Nathan here of LSE, is one of the experts in this country on this. He's published widely on showing that this is true here in the UK as well. Greater cultural diversity of cities and firms boosts innovation. Trade and tourism, talked about that in Leeds. Yes, migration will lead to more trade and tourism. Inbound and outbound. The net effect, however, is country-specific. In New Zealand, actually, we find imports go up more than exports. And inbound tourism goes up a bit less than outbound tourism because of the linkages we create between countries through migration. So, as I said, the whole picture is complex. There's a whole range of things. Some countries will find positive effects in some areas, others, the effects may be different in that context. So, the question is it possible to incorporate all effects in one large model of the economy? Well, central banks, treasuries, have a long tradition of doing so. In New Zealand and Australia, we've been using something called the computable general equilibrium model to look at these kind of large supply shocks. The reason are actually twofold. One is these models, which are huge, they contain every sector of the economy, every type of job, every occupation. Computers can handle them, not a problem. They have a big advantage. One is that you can, because it's a computer model, you can do what-if scenarios, so you can vary the scenarios greatly. Secondly, because they are so detailed, they precisely are the best to give you the distributional effects. So the macro is not what matters there, but it's the distribution. And the macro, in fact, that's the problem. There's no such thing as a free lunch. You always have to pay a price. The macro of these models is rather based on assumptions. So you gain in the micro, but the macro, it's very sensitive to the assumptions you make there. Also, in economies that are highly services-driven, the models are not as informative because these models go back to the input-output tables that were developed by people like Leontief and tell you a lot about how industrial economies, how sectors interact. But they're not so good in the modern knowledge-driven kind of soft kind of knowledge-based services sectors. So it's also quite cumbersome to deal with things like just non-market activities, expectations and monetary factors. But let me just nonetheless give you the results of one New Zealand study. In the bar chart on the left, you see in blue what would happen over a 15-year period if New Zealand cut its immigration to zero. The red shows you what New Zealand would happen if New Zealand doubled its immigration from 20,000 per year, as it was net immigration, this was in 2009, to 40,000. What you see is that the blue, so it's clearly negative, so it's, things are getting worse compared with the red, where things are getting better, but the blue bars are bigger than the red, so the situation is asymmetric. And I can exploit that by asking, is there such a thing as an optimal rate of immigration? So on the right-hand side, I draw these points, and I must admit there are only 3 points, and then I do a little bit of kind of creative thinking. If we see that it's leveling off, at some stage it may be starting to go down. Nobody knows where it would be. I've drawn it at a rate of 1%, which would be, for a population like New Zealand, 4.5 million, so it would be 45,000 on average. This is not just for 1 year. That would be the average per year over a long period of time, because we're talking about 15-year periods here. We've never reached that. New Zealand has never had anything like that. It's had about 0.5% population growth due to immigration. So we don't really know what this graph exactly looks like, and it will vary across countries. But it does suggest that there is such a thing as, from the GDP per capita point of view, an optimal rate. Even so, the optimal rate would surely be dependent on more than just GDP per capita. This would just be one input into that process. And what you will say, so far, I haven't said anything about the social impact. So let's move to that issue. In New Zealand, there has been a strong and ongoing relationship between the researchers and the policy arena. And this is an example of it. Cadence is the project that was already mentioned before. We'll go on to 2020, and it includes also social effects. And what we do here is we're looking at Auckland, and the graph called FFR1 shows you the share of immigrants in each of the parts of Auckland. On average, it's 40%, and actually a lot of parts of Auckland have a fair, if you look at the numbers, it's a lot of them are quite dark, so there's a lot of immigration in lots of parts of Auckland. The right-hand side shows you the diversity among the migrants. So there, it's about how diverse within that group of foreign-born. And you can see there's correlation, but it's not exactly the same thing. We see a lot of diversity among the migrants, for example, in the city centre, but also near the airport and in other parts of South Auckland. So this clustering aspect is, as I said, a major impact in a major part of our Cadence research, and we've been recently looking at the issue of social capital. Social capital is about networks, trust, and participation. Matt Rosgrooch and I have been looking particularly at what we call bonding versus bridging. And we see that in these clusters, there's a lot of bonding, which means that people interact within the community. But in order, as research shows, to obtain better labour market outcomes, bridging turns out to be quite important. There are jobs in the clusters as well, but in what may not necessarily be the best jobs available in the urban labour market. And that then brings me also to the issue of the migrants and their cultural identity in the host country and what's going on in the home country. I could spend an entire lecture on talking about the sending countries. I put the slide in because, as I said, I think of migration as a global issue. You cannot ignore the impacts on the sending countries. There are lots of impacts there that I just list here as bullet points. The diaspora networks is actually a colleague, a New Zealand colleague, Alan Gamlin from Victoria University, is one of the world's leaders on this. He also works at Oxford. He shows how important they are for inter-country relations and for government to understanding international migration. There is a lot of research on families, on the impact on regions in developing countries. The remittances, which are of the order of $600 billion, more double as important as official assistance to developing countries. Trade and foreign direct investment effects. There's the whole issue of the brain drain versus brain gain, because in these developing countries, what we do find is that there's a growth in non-compulsory education if there is an opportunity for people to go abroad. So all of this, as you will understand, also remains passionately debated. So how did this evidence get used in the past? Here's just the New Zealand experience, and I won't go into details. A lot of websites you can check. Started out in the 1980s. The first work that I did on this led it to a book, which, of course, as author, you're always kind of keen to know. It is here in the London libraries, at least some of the ones, certainly in the one, I think, at LSE, and at the... it's always good to know. It's an old book, but you can look it up here. And it was the start of the ongoing relationship between us and government. They funded that book. They funded research which involved also a whole range of public sector departments that provided input to it. It was this big modelling exercise. Subsequently, there have been many other studies. Some of them are referred to here. We also have really good data. And also, yeah, they're summarised in the 2010 paper, which is you can also look up, downloadable. The data in New Zealand situation is very good. Countries can be envious of New Zealand because we have something called the integrated data infrastructure, which is rather than using one longitudinal survey, which is very costly, we now link a whole bunch of administrative and survey data, including even also the censuses, although we're still working on that. What that does is that gives you a continuing longitudinal environment of data under strict confidentiality conditions. This is clearly all under controls that ensures that the Statistics Act in New Zealand, which is very, very clear on not releasing individual details, is preserved. The final thing I want to point out, what we do in New Zealand, is we have the policymakers and the researchers meet on an annual basis in something called the Pathways Conference. On this topic, there's also a conference on other research, but this is just on the migration topic. Once a year, the conference is held in Wellington, usually started by the Minister, Honourable Michael Woodhouse, started the conference this year with his opening speech. And in fact, we also have keynote speakers. So once again, I guess I can refer to Max Nathan, who was kindly enough to fly all the way around the world to be one of the keynote speakers at our conference. Now, in the remaining minutes, and I know I will try to get through this all that quickly, but I will to allow for questions and certainly also for the discussion. But I do want to point these out, is that what is the politics of immigration policy when you have all this evidence? Well, what matters, of course, is the voting behavior. And for that, what we need to look at is the distribution of gains and losses. We saw businesses benefit more on average than employees. Because there are, however, far more employee voters than business owners voters, on that account, you would expect political pressure to normally restrict immigration. But the situation is far more complex than that. First of all, there are these generally accepted spillover benefits, particularly from highly skilled workers. So in a sense, everyone agrees that high-skilled people are welcome. Secondly, low-skilled people are welcome when there's a visible shortage. When there's a shortage of carers, construction workers, there tends to be less debate about whether that can be part of immigration or not. Also, what we find is that support for immigration does actually tend to be quite bipartisan. You can find support both on the left and on the right, but for different reasons. On the right, it's because of more likely to be on the business lobby. On the left, it's because of issues of persisting injustices and inequalities, and of course, the consequence of those for all countries of the world, as again, recent events have made very clear. Despite the considerable evidence base that I talked about, there continues to be also misunderstandings. And those misunderstandings shape attitudes. So we need to understand better why do these misunderstandings get continually referred to and discussed over the years. Because, in fact, we see that there is a problem here. The weight of the evidence that I've been discussing with you tonight is rather abstract. Science is not easy to kind of feel. It's mainly macro and meso. The actual experience is on the ground. It's local, micro. So what we do see now is that there's a recognition of this. So researchers are moving more and more towards looking at the micro evidence. And one example of this is another big project I had the privilege of being involved in. It's called Migrant Diversity and Regional Disparity in Europe. It was run through the Centre for Research and Analysis of Migration, which I mentioned before, led by Christian Dussmann. And in the work that we did there, there's work by Simonetta Longhi at Essex University and Jesse Bakens from Amsterdam that started looking at what makes people happy in the context of migration, what concerns them, and what determines their attitudes. What that research suggests is basically the following. People generally love diversity as long as it's in the high street and not in their street. Sadly, the Norface program finished in 2013. I think there's a need for more of these this was very multidisciplinary, by the way. There were 12 projects ranging across all the, including humanities and social sciences. So how do we move forward from here? The first point I'd like to make is that immigration sits at an intersection, as it's become clear to you now undoubtedly, of a whole range of government ministries and areas. It requires inputs from Treasury, the departments responsible for employment and training, housing, social welfare, security, big one right now, foreign affairs, international trade. Now, I've been involved in these discussions, and what do you find? There's this big difference in culture across departments. They talk sideways because they have different perspectives of the world, different world views. To bring that together is hard. And so what New Zealand again has tried to do to, in the past, stimulate this is we had something called CDRPs, cross-departmental research programs. They were very helpful, but we've now moved to something new, which is called National Science Challenges. There are 11 of these currently, and they cover a whole range of big challenges for New Zealand. They're big, $73 million of research money per pro, per, no, sorry, that's no, that would be even, it's the total budget, sorry. Not for each of the 11, for 11 projects. They're wide-ranging, including climate change, land and sea use, productivity, aging, education, even housing and the future of cities. So another point I want to make is that the policies currently are not yet dealing effectively with this change in migration from the permanent to the temporary and the growing complexity. For example, Social Security. Whenever I travel around the world, the administration you deal with can't understand if you want to be some professional who wants to just spend a few months in another part of the world. They make it hard for you to open bank accounts, to do all sorts of, to have health insurance. So that's another thing that needs to change. Thirdly, governments need to realize because of this churn, flux, continuing inward migration, outward migration, at large levels, and net migration is being slow. Net migration is not a good target. There's no point in saying we should have X people as a net target for the country. So it's uncontrollable. However, what also tends to happen is governments realize that there is this going on, but they control some part of it. And what they tend to do is when the economy booms, they increase that number. When the economy contracts, they make it less. But by doing that, they in fact increase the amplitude of the whole thing. So you're basically running with what the market economy is already doing and making, in a sense, if there's going to be a cycle, the cycle is going to be even more spread between top and the bottom. So we also need better evaluation of settlement and diversity policies. This came very clear to me. Last week I went to a very nice conference on local development in the UK. The keynote speakers there and the whole panel made the point that we're actually very bad at local level project evaluation. Be interested in comments of my discussions on that. Also, because the design is quite often not carefully enough looking at what are the control situations. There's too much happening that is not taken into account. We also can do far better in bridging academic research and policy design by making the evidence base really accessible. And as I said, the Pathways Conference New Zealand is really good in that respect. By allowing for secondments, so where people from the public sector go and work some time in academia, and people from academia spend some time in the policy sector. And one of the advantages of that is that what I find as a researcher, I keep on dealing with new people every time I interact with the public sector because there's a lot of restructuring going on. And you see quite a lot of turnover of staff. So the evidence base and this kind of networking needs to be on a more permanent basis that allows the weight of the evidence to be there and on an ongoing basis. Furthermore, we should all just do this on a cross-departmental approach, and we should allow for better dissemination. Well, that then brings me to the end of this, and I would like to finish with some acknowledgements. Clearly, I'd like to start with thanking the Foundation, again, Sir Graham Davies, as the chair of the Foundation, and all our other trustees for having given me the opportunity for on this marvellous visiting professorship for 3 months. I clearly also would like to thank Lisa Fletcher here at the front, who's been the person organising, liaising with all the locations that I've been to, and basically always being there and actually following me as kind of my groupie going around the country. In fact, there have been more groupies, and I'll mention them in a moment. Before I do that, thank again, of course, Professor Andres Rodriguez-Posé, Professor Jonathan Wadsworth for their contribution to tonight, and soon we'll have the discussion. But finally, I'd like to, and I shouldn't forget the School of Advanced Study, where they had a nice office, although I was told to leave my office because they have their foundation day today. So, but that's fine for the rest of being a beautiful place to work from. And finally, then, I'd like to thank my wife, Heather, and my family. Son Martin is here, and my other children who can't be here with us tonight but live in the UK, in London, in fact, would you believe, more migrants from New Zealand, for having been supporting me during my time here, and for actually coming along to the talks when they could. And finally, I'd like to thank you for turning up here on this Wednesday night. So thank you very much. You're going to use your slides?
Yeah, no, your slides.
You're going to use my slides? Okay, fair enough.
No, I'm not.
Okay, thanks. Well, I'm sort of very happy to come and sort of discuss Jack's paper. Jack and I go back at least 20 years. We both met when we were temporary migrants in Australia. I was on an international exchange of a different sort. I had an Australian girlfriend at the time, but but it was all about the exchange of ideas and things, which is what migration is all about. To get along quite quickly. I collect affiliations, as you can see, but one thing I'm going to have to sort of comment on is the last affiliation, which is I'm still a member of the UK Home Office's Migration Advisory Committee. I thought when I agreed to talk here that I would have finished by now, but it turns out not to be the case. So that just means I'm sort of constrained a little bit by collective responsibility about what I can say and what I can't say about UK government policy. So forgive me if I'm a bit non-committal. I have to say I agree almost totally with everything that Jacques has just said, so we could almost go straight to the discussion now. But if you want to just hear me sort of blather on for about 5 or 10 minutes to just reinforce some of the things Jacques said, then here we go. Okay, there's no doubt that as Jacques said, that, you know, migration is one of the most significant developments to hit the UK, but also most of the many other OECD countries over the past 20 years. And I think here in the UK, we tend to think, you know, we're all a bit parochial, we tend to think that migration is only happening here. And clearly it's not. I mean, there's a nice chart from the OECD, which basically the blue lines are 2000 and the diamonds are 2013. And basically in every OECD country, migration has gone up, with the exception of Estonia. It's gone down. And Israel, yeah. But basically, the point is, it's a global phenomenon, and it's happening everywhere. It's basically not unique to a few countries. The other thing is that I think sometimes we're in danger of forgetting, and you know, Jacques alluded to it. That is, it's very diverse in terms of its the motivations for migration, not only within countries but also across countries. So again, this is from the OECD. They basically split permanent migrants. So this says, it says nothing about students, which is a big sort of addition, or indeed intra-company transfers. But these are just permanent movements. And you can still see that free movements, which are basically, you think of that, of movements across EU countries. So that's quite common, not surprising, in EU countries, but less common in countries that don't have free movement of labour, not a member of a block like the EU, but also even within the EU, that sort of countries like Sweden, where humanitarian, i.e. refugees, the share of migrants who are refugees is much higher in countries like Sweden than it is in other countries. So the reason I sort of raise this point is that basically that matters a lot for the policy response, because if the sources of migration are different, then the policy responses to migration are necessarily different, and that basically means that we shouldn't adopt a one-size-fits-all policy for all countries, because That simply won't work. You know, you need to tailor your policy response to the actual factors that are responsible for immigration. So I think that sort of needs to be sort of, you know, kept in mind when we think about designing appropriate policy responses. Okay, I'm just going to again sort of reinforce again what Jacques said. I mean, about the empirical evidence on immigration. And here I'm just going to concentrate on the UK evidence. But it's certainly true for the UK that most of what we know about the labour market effects, we think we know, is the finding is broadly neutral. So there don't seem to be big employment effects. There are enough studies around that say that there are not really any big wage effects. Though again, as Jacques said, that average effect disguises the fact that there are winners and losers from this process. So that certain groups may well be come under greater wage pressure than others. But again, even that finding suggests that the ones who are under most threat, the effect is not that big. And it's a similar story when it comes to fiscal impact. So there's, Jacques mentioned the study by Christian Dussmann, which basically finds positive or neutral fiscal impacts. They get positive fiscal impacts, in other words, net fiscal contributions, positive fiscal contributions, paying more in taxes than you do take out in benefits. There's positive effects from EU migrants. Now, again, that shouldn't be surprising because EU migrants tend to be younger. They're all in work. Most of them are all in work. And therefore, it's not surprising that they put in more than they take out. They're healthier because they're younger. And then you get sort of similar contributions as the sort of domestic UK population from other migrants who've been in the country a longer period of time. And again, we shouldn't be surprised at that because basically, as Jacques alluded to, the longer migrants have been in the country, the more they look like domestic residents. And therefore, it's not surprising that their tax contributions and welfare contributions are pretty much the same because they basically assimilate into the population. So, again, we shouldn't be too surprised about these fiscal impact effects. So what are the other effects that we know? Well, we're starting to get a massive body of evidence on these things. Prices, what do we know about prices? Because why would immigrants affect prices? Well, it's partly to do with the industrial sector mix that the immigrants work in, but it's also about relative demand effects. And the net evidence seems to be not much. What about education? Well, there's all these concerns about education crowding, sort of competing for resources. Does it affect educational outcomes? Well, again, not much. Housing, alluded to it. Does it affect housing? Well, again, the evidence of the UK suggests that population growth matters for housing, but actually immigrant growth doesn't, because for the reasons that Jacques alluded to. Immigrants tend to go in areas where housing is cheaper. Some people move out when immigrants go in. So the effect of immigration on housing doesn't seem to be very big either. Crime, there goes the neighbourhood effect. It doesn't seem to exist. Apart from amongst asylum seekers. It seems to be that burglaries go with asylum seekers. And then again, we shouldn't be too surprised about that because asylum seekers have no recourse to income while their asylum claim is being treated to. And therefore, you know... it probably shouldn't be too surprising that people without incomes have to maybe resort to something like that. But as far as other immigrants are concerned, there seems to have absolutely no effect on crime. Health, now that works from both the supply and the demand effect. Do immigrants demand more from health services? Well, no, they don't, because basically they're younger, they're fitter, and therefore they're healthier. That's the essence of that effect. And also immigrants have been used in the UK to staff the health service. The health service will probably collapse without the presence of immigrants. So on that side, it's sort of, there's not much effect. But, okay, so what does not much effect mean? Well, if you think about that, that basically means that no effect means that, well, things might have been the same without any immigration. Okay? Because if the broad effect is neutral, well, that means... wouldn't make any difference whether immigration had gone up or not. So does it? And again, I agree with Jacques here. That basically means that if we're looking for effects of immigration, then we've got to look at things the other externalities that we can't measure, the things that are by definition harder to measure. And that's the thing about these spillovers, potential spillovers from diversity, or even negative effects like congestion effects. And we're not sure about congestion effects. How do we actually measure these things? But it may be that we need to concentrate our efforts in these areas to try and come up with answers. And it's not easy. You know, the reasons why people do these things in order, because these are the easiest things to look at. These things are harder. And that's, but that, I think I agree, again, I agree with Jack, that's where we probably need to focus our efforts next. But we do need to think about, you know, well, you know, what's the difference? Okay, so coming on to sort of things that that Jacques mentioned about policy targets, again, just focusing on the UK, certainly true that UK has a net immigration target, and that also includes EU immigration numbers, of which it has absolutely no control. So it's very difficult to target something over which you don't have a control, but that's one for the policymakers. But I think it also sort of needs to be said that something that when you begin to think about targeting a net immigration figure, net basically is the difference between inflows and outflows, and most policy in the UK is basically targeted on the inflows rather than being targeted on outflows, and sort of when you sort of think about that, actually, if you start sort of playing around with this, you know, if outflows were to go up more than inflows were to go down, then you could basically change the immigrant stock with sort of, you know, very different policies aimed at sort of increasing turnover. In fact, you could actually get, you know, little effect on immigrant numbers, but you can have more turnover simply by sort of, you know, encouraging the sort of temporary policies that Jacques was alluding to. And that basically means, you know, to, you know, encouraging more students, more intra-company transfers, more temporary working. And that would sort of, you know, increase churn, but it wouldn't necessarily increase numbers. I'm not going to sort of come down either way on what the consequences of that might be, largely because we don't know what the consequences of that might be. But certainly in terms of policy, you know, targeting both inflows and outflows gives you a bit more room for scope, so that it gives you more ability to sort of, you know, address potential issues. And I don't think we've done enough about that here in the UK, or indeed, you know, elsewhere, looking at sort of looking at these things in the round. Jacques mentioned migration impact assessments. I only found this out recently, but every time the UK government implements a policy, it doesn't have to be a migration policy. It has to do with what's called an impact assessment, which basically means somebody has to do a cost benefit analysis of the policy. And it's certainly true that the one that they were doing for immigrants until very recently made absolutely no distinction of the impact on residents and immigrants. So they were basically looking at the overall impact of immigration and made no attempt until recently to sort of separate the potential effects. Now that's you know, we should be doing things like that because we know, as Jacques said, we need to know who gains and who loses from immigration. And if you just do a sort of blanket assessment about the overall effects, that actually, you know, that's not going to tell you who wins and who loses, and that's important in framing the debate. And the answer, again, I'm just agreeing again, is as Jacques already said, the answer of who gains and who benefits depends on who are the closest substitutes, who complements immigrant labour, and that. And again, so we need more evidence on who's substitute. The one thing I don't say I disagree with Jack on this, but the meta-analyses, I think it's good, but I'm sort of less, I'm probably a bit less pro on meta-analyses. The reason is that you've got to be careful to compare like with like, because, you know, I mean, but for the reason that I alluded to, if you're doing cross-country studies with all these countries with different institutional arrangements, you know, different rules on who can come and who can go, then you just need to be a little bit careful about that heterogeneity, because, you know, heterogeneity amongst the immigrant stock or heterogeneity amongst across policies, you know, you do need to sort of take account of that when you do these meta-analyses. But having done that, you know, I did a sort of impromptu meta-analysis just summarising the UK literature. I mean, but you know, that was within UK. But I, you know, I'm as guilty of it as anyone. But so there is a usefulness. Okay, so but here comes the but. So I'm absolutely in favour of as much empirical evidence on these very complex issues as we possibly must. It's absolutely fundamental that we need to do that. But here comes the but. even the best academic policy has to come alongside public opinion. And again, Jack said this. And it's certainly true that amongst the UK public, immigration is the foremost concern. Here's a graph from Ipsos Mori. Every month they basically ask people what their most pressing concerns are facing Britain today. And the red line is basically immigration. So it goes up, and then interestingly it goes down in the recession. When the economy becomes takes over as the pressing concern, but now it's up here as the pressing concern. So there's no escaping the fact that it's the dominant issue in terms of the public debate, and that we have to take account of. Interestingly, Britain's sort of a bit of an outlier when it comes to immigration, because here basically what doesn't show what this is, but this is the percentage. Thinking that who say that immigration is important, and this is actually the share of the population who are migrants. So Luxembourg is out here because basically everybody in Luxembourg is a migrant. I paraphrase, but it's you know. But here's Britain. So it's in the middle, but Britain is actually a middle-ranking country when with respect to immigration. It's not it's pretty much near the OECD average. But it's alongside Latvia, it takes a sort of the prize for being the most sort of the people who think immigration is the biggest concern, whereas people with similar, even Greece, people with countries with similar sort of migrant populations have much less concern about immigration. And it's also true that concern about immigration is probably inversely, as Jack said, inversely correlated with your exposure to immigrants, because it's much less prevalent amongst young people and urban dwellers in the UK, and it's much more common against older people and suburbanites. But this is important. You can't escape the fact that this is important. And policy needs to be formulated not just on the weights of evidence about immigration, but also it has to take account of public concern, or at least the public has to be informed about these things. And shaping attitudes is not easy. It's not easy to shape attitudes. But in shaping attitudes, I think we have to take account of how the effects of future policy might affect current policy may affect attitudes in the future. So I'd just like to take a couple of UK examples. Not UK, any country. Suppose you want to sort of restrict public spending. Well, one of the consequences of that is that you may have to rely on immigrants to sort of staff your public services, because the reservation wage of immigrants, on average, tends to be lower, and therefore you're able to staff your public services not on the cheap, but cheaper than you would be if you had to pay higher wages. But that basically may have consequences, because the career options of domestic residents may be restricted as a result, and that may influence attitudes to immigration. But also allowing skilled migration may reduce incentive to train workers domestically, and again, this could affect attitudes to immigration. I can't get a training job. So that you have to think about the sort of dynamic consequences of policy when you shape them, and how that could sort of reflect attitudes. So what's the way forward? Well, it's pretty clear that immigration pressures are not going to go away. As long as there are income differentials, as long as there are wars, as long as there are climate differences, there's always going to be pressure on immigration. So in terms of asking what do we want, it has to be what do we want as citizens of country J, because what we want may not be the same as citizens of country X. What we have to ask is whether immigration is consistent with what citizens of country J want. And that means, should policy focus more on controlling immigration or addressing the consequences of immigration? Because you can formulate policies to sort of restrict immigration, or you could allow immigration and deal with the consequences. Or you could do both. And probably you should do both. Yeah. But the point is that it really does depend on individual country circumstances and individual institutions allied with voter opinions as to what you do. That's the key. And there's no universal, there's not universal answer there. But I think, I'll finish here. Whatever you choose to do, you can't make informed decisions until you're informed. And that basically means we need good, relevant evidence into the debate. And it's not one size fits all. It has to be relevant and it has to be good. And what also you need is the ability and indeed willingness of policymakers to access and use this evidence. Because you can have all the best evidence in the world, but if nobody's reading it or nobody's engaging, then nothing's going to happen. And maybe these, you know, independent advisory bodies that, you know, Jacques and I are members of, well, maybe are evidence of potentially the way forward. But it needs a much wider debate than that. And talking of debates, why don't we have one?
Thank you very much, Jonathan, for your presentation. We got about 10 minutes for questions from the audience before we have the reception. I'm sure you're all hungry at this stage. So who would like to open the debate? Yes, back.
Hello. This is to anyone, really. Just sort of looking at a lot of issues that people have around and sort of negative opinions people might have around migration, refugees, and everything like that, particularly in the UK. I think a lot of attitudes can be sort of dealt with actually just by myth busting. Sometimes it's just as simple as that, people not actually understanding that so GDP is a positive thing as a result of migration. But one thing that I think sort of pro-immigration, kind of traditionally more left thinking people, I think, sometimes fail to address is that concern around the fact that the people that are going to be most negatively hit as a result of immigration are the people that are most similar. So sort of traditionally very working class people. What do you think, there's like a really innovative solution that we can sort of launch to address this? Because it is an issue. And just because I might think that immigration and welcoming refugees is a really good thing, there are genuine concerns for people that are struggling to sort of get by as it is. And I struggle sometimes when I'm having conversations with people like that to really have a response. So do you think there's a way of addressing it?
Would you like me to start with the response? Before I'll thank you, address your question, I'd also like to say that I fully agree with what Jonathan said. So I think we've got a united panel here. I also, of course, Andres may be able to comment on his perspective. What strikes me really, having been involved in this for three decades now, that it does seem to be very hard to make this weight of the evidence kind of get a fair hearing. And sometimes, because I think there are definitely political reasons why somebody may not want to listen to the evidence, one particular one that I get strikes me as, having worked in this area for so long and being interviewed fairly regularly, is after all this work that we've done that both Jonathan and I talked about, that even if there's some wage effect, because we know that migrants are willing to work perhaps for lesser wages sometimes than locals might be, so people, unskilled people, as you said, may be concerned about that. We know that this idea that migrants are here to rob your jobs is just untrue, and I still see it as headlines, even in New Zealand. So I think it then becomes an instrument for some particular, you know, form of antagonism of creating some kind of, and that worries me. I would say in terms of the actual situation the world is facing now, what we probably should be concerned with more and is this very new trend of, and in fact a lot of the evidence, again Jonathan can comment on, where we have seen what has really affected the people with the lower skills is the what we call skill-biased technological change. That's what's been really transforming the labor market and which led to all these jobs that were out there previously have now either been transformed or have gone, and that's where we still may have future changes taking place. It's not so much in the immigration, but in terms of attitudes, what you can also do is, if you want to make people aware of this, I think you have to start at the schooling system. The only way to really educate people is to start with the young generation and right from the start. So if you, and we are doing in New Zealand work on diversity in schools, and we're doing it right, you know, from grassroots level up. So we are. Then what you find is that you can get a better understanding because you start to, as it were, educate people right from the beginning. So that's
point. Yeah, it's starting to sound like the election, isn't it? I agree with Jack. I mean, again, just to reinforce the point. I mean, the point you made is that you know, migrant, the working class, are hit worse. And I mean, 2 points here. You know, by and large, the migrants who are coming to the UK are not direct competitors with that group. I mean, there's a restrictions for a start on non-EU migrants who are basically, they have to be graduates essentially to get in. And the EU migrants who come in are essentially graduates anyway. So that, you know, they're not, despite all sort of things, they're not direct competitors. And the work we've done basically suggests that actually the people who are most likely to be hit by immigration are previous waves of immigrants, because they're the closest substitutes. So they're the ones who are most at thing. But, you know, that goes, and again, as Jack said, you know, the factors that are causing decline in these areas are not primarily driven by remigration. But, I mean, the important point, you know, how do we influence attitudes? You know, I'm from sort of South Yorkshire. You know, people are sort of hesitant. Well, I was going to call them Mets, but people I know who have, you know, pretty hostile attitudes to immigration. You know, what's going to change that? Well, it's not me just telling them. Well, actually, the academic evidence suggests that attitudes have no effect. You know, they're not going to listen. And so Jack's point about school is a valid one. But you know, what do you do about adults? And, you know, until there's, you know, until that through the media, there's a sort of, you know, a more sort of neutral attitude to the effects of, or balanced attitude to the effect of immigration, then, it's going to be very difficult to change that. But it needs to come from, you know, some wider media other than just me and you, because, you know, we can talk to people, but that's not going to, you know, change everybody's attitude.
Right. More questions? I'm going to follow on this, if I may, and I got a question why is most of the media so averse to immigrants, and especially to certain types of immigrants? Why is, let's say, one Daily Mail headline saying fictitious Muslim immigrant called Muhammad, who has 15 children and claims so much money on benefits, is more influential than 100 academic papers by Christian Dasmond and yourself saying that the fiscal impact is either neutral or, if anything, positive?
I mean, it's a very good question. I mean, you know, the editors of the Mail would argue that they're just reflecting their opinions of their readers, so it's, you know, it becomes a circular argument. I mean, primarily it's about access. I mean, you know, we don't have access to, you know, the mainstream as much as we might think. You know, we don't go out there and proselytize, for whatever, you know, for want of a better word. And, you know, maybe it's about an imbalance of resources in that respect. But, you know, why editors who are, by and large, the offspring of immigrants themselves, you know, want to do that? Is beyond me.
Maybe I can comment on this from the New Zealand context. And what I would like to mention is that I went to a conference, I think it was 2 years ago, where there was somebody, senior person from the media, from the newspaper media, was giving a keynote. And he argued that the media are really having a tough time, particularly newspapers. And abstract stuff, it just becomes what sells, as was mentioned. What sells is not abstract stuff. It's the human interest story, right? This is why we watch human interest stories on TV all the time, on these, you know, these programs. Well, I don't, but some people do. But so I think it is there's a commercial reason why big headlines on human interest situations are selling, and even big achievements, unless it's something like finding a new particle or something in physics that sometimes might get to the headlines, it's hard to make research fascinating to the average reader of the media. And that's not denigrating, because a lot of people do read, you know, the high quality our work that's out there across a range of magazines and media. So,
okay. Any more questions coming from the audience? Yes.
Yeah, thank you for raising that question. New Zealand is in quite a special situation. We also have, of course, a large population of indigenous people, the Maori population. They're about 15% of the population, and we have a treaty that was signed in 1840, was not always adhered to, but is again very much at the front of policy at the moment. That's about making sure that New Zealand is a bicultural society and that the rights of Māori are taken into account. So if you bring in then other groups of people from different cultural backgrounds, that does raise a challenge, because how are you going to preserve the bicultural nature of the society as well as permitting this growing diversity? And just on the whole, New Zealanders have been quite positive about immigration. So I do find, and my colleagues that also work both sides of the world and come to European conferences, we do find a difference in terms of average attitudes. The concerns are definitely bigger. Well, you know from the Australian case as well. I think, you know, it isn't that those negative attitudes are there, but they're not as kind of dominant in the discourse as they are here. So far, I think we've been able to manage quite well. And of course, this project that I'm talking about, about capturing the diversity dividend, we have a whole stream of research about, you know, how do Māori interact with migrants and what do they feel this means to them and how can we improve that situation.
Yeah. Negative view, given that they're so culturally similar.
Well, they haven't always. They're currently, to be honest, I find it very difficult to understand as well. They're very concerned about the security issue, clearly, and that's them having that one issue drive everything else, which is, I think, doesn't seem. But I've not lived this. How long were you in Australia? Well, it's a long time ago now, isn't it?
So that was over 6 months.
In those days, it was. It varies over time. So I think I agree with you that I think it's very much a political issue. But you see, Australia is also, I should point this out, and New Zealanders are not very much wanted there either. Even though there is 600,000 of us living in Australia, and the average person there will say, oh yeah, great that you're here, but when you go to the politics of it, currently New Zealanders in Australia have no right to social security, even though they may be living there since 2001. That policy was abolished in 2001 to give, so New Zealanders may be working there, living there, and even today, as was pointed out to me, my wife, earlier on, there's news paper articles about New Zealanders who feel that they're treated as second-class citizens. So I think Australia's a bit different from New Zealand in a number of ways.
Okay, thank you very much. I've been told that the food might be getting cold. I don't know if it's hot or cold food, but nevertheless, I think most of us are very hungry. It's been a very interesting session. I'll invite you all to come to the reception on the 8th floor, if I remember well. And I would like to thank both Jax and Jonathan for a very, very nice and interesting presentation.
Thank you.